Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, August 12th, 1996. In the fireside room this morning, our speaker is Judy Saterin. Today, she will be beginning her series on issues on mental health and illness. Today's session number is 1 and is titled, Depression, Beyond the Blues. Let's listen in.
I guess we can roll the tape, wherever they are. I'm Judy Saterin. This is those of you who read the little description up on the kiosk. This is my first time on the teaching staff. I do teach at St. Olaf College, so it's appropriate that I'm here during Old Week. I also teach at Gustavus, and I teach nursing students, just to give you some perspective so you know my focus.
What kind of students?
Nursing students, basically psychiatric nursing. The topic that I've chosen for today's session is on depression, which is a little different than I think the other sessions that you're probably experiencing this week. I think it does fit in with the theme. I had to reach a little to do that. And if you read the description of what I was going to do again on the kiosk, I read it quickly when Deanne put it up, and I think I read it as I will talk about understanding mental health and things to do to prevent it. That's how I read it. And I thought, whoa, people are going to read this and probably want to stay away from this session. That's really not my intention. But I do have 3 sessions that are scheduled that relate to issues around mental illness. The reason for that is primarily because that's what I work with. My practice has been with people with mental illness. Depression is something that I think we all experience, so it isn't something that's foreign to any one of us. But what I want to talk about with you today, and hopefully discuss with you, are issues that relate to understanding depression, and primarily severe depression, which is something that's very prevalent and I think is very misunderstood by many people. We'll see. So my intent is not that we're going to talk about ways you can prevent mental health. That's not it at all. And I think fitting in with the theme, if there can be any increased understanding of what it's like to experience depression, what it's like for the individual, what it's like for family members, that maybe we can wash away some of the stigma that surrounds illnesses like depression. And I'll be talking later in the week about schizophrenia, which is certainly surrounded by stigma. So that's my attempt to fit it in with the theme. So basically what I'd like to do is to go through, I don't know where you are in terms of your understanding of depression. I assume that's why you're here, is to gain a little better understanding. And what I do with students is who are working with patients with depression, I think most importantly, is that they learn to understand as much as they can what it's like for this person who is experiencing the depression. So I spend a lot of time trying to sensitize them, help them understand from the inside out what it's like. And again, with depression, I think it's not real difficult because depression is a universal experience. It isn't something that any of us can avoid to one degree or another. So please, I certainly will allow time for questions. I don't intend for this to be a lecture. Again, I don't know what your understanding is, so interrupt at any point with questions, comments, experiences. That's what you're used to doing.
It's hard to hear you.
Is it? Do people use this?
It doesn't, Judy, that does not, it only records, it does not.
Okay, so I'll just speak up.
Else. So you need to use your own projection.
Okay, I do have a voice that tends to be low, so if that happens, if it sinks down again, just wave at me, okay? One of the reasons, I guess some of the data that makes me think it's important to talk about depression with a general audience, there's an organization called SAVE. It's an awareness organization having to do with suicide and depression. And a recent survey that was done by the National Institute of Mental Health indicated that 71% of people in this country believe that depressive brain disease, as they label it, is an emotional illness. And 45% believe brain disease is an individual's choice that can be willed away. And that's something I think that there is some prevalence to that idea, that depression is something that an individual may get into to some extent by their own choice or their actions, and if they worked hard enough, they could get themselves out of it. That's not my understanding of depression, and that's what I wanted to share with you. Just a little bit about the magnitude of depression. I like to throw in a little bit so everybody's got something, statistics and a little bit of history. In this country, we can consider depression to be the number one mental health problem, and that's probably no surprise to anybody. Very prevalent. It's called the common cold of psychiatric illnesses. It's a very prevalent disorder. Probably many more than 30 million Americans will suffer an episode of depression or mania during their lifetimes. About 5% of people in this country will experience a major depressive illness. So it's a significant number of people that experience depression that's severe enough that they come to the attention of healthcare providers. And that includes a fair number of adolescents. It also includes children. And it certainly involves the elderly. People in the upper age range are very much at risk for depression, and it's very often overlooked. And we might want to talk about why that is a little later. Women are affected more than men. Statistics demonstrate that probably twice as many women suffer from depression as do men. There may be a number of reasons for that, not just the fact that women may seek out health care more frequently, but also there are hormonal kinds of changes that may occur. I can notice my voice starting to go down already. Other kinds of things in general that are related to depression tends to occur or to surface somewhere in early adulthood. Females tend to develop depression at an earlier age than males and tend to have longer episodes. So those of us in the room who are female, that's considered a risk factor, one of the risk factors for depression. But the average age of onset for depression, as with some other disorders, has decreased since about World War II. So when we used to see people middle-aged coming to the healthcare setting with depression, now it's moving into an earlier age. And that's not unusual, there are other things, certainly. Average age of onset for depression, severe depression, is about 27. It's about 18 for what's called bipolar depression, and I don't know how many people are familiar with that, but when I talk about depression, severe depression, talking about both what's called unipolar, straight depression, and also bipolar depression, and that's manic depressive illness. That's maybe a more familiar term. Individuals who experience both the peaks and the valleys, the highs and the lows. Crosses all cultures, certainly it's not restricted to this culture. And in terms of its impact, it's a very disabling disease. And I am using the term disease because that's my orientation, is that depression, as well as some of the other psychiatric illnesses, are diseases. Depressed individuals spend more time in bed or bedtime than people with any other disorder except cardiovascular. And people with severe depression will always rate themselves as more impaired from depression than from chronic physical disorders. So that individuals who suffer from it will rate themselves as being more impaired than what we might think in terms of chronic physical disorders. Certainly very often correlated with substance abuse. That's probably well known to you, that there's a high correlation between depression and substance abuse, particularly with individuals who have manic depressive disease. Very high correlation. So again, that has an added impact. And it's often fatal. And again, that's something that you probably are very familiar with because of the high rate of suicide, is something I'd like to talk more about tomorrow. The largest survey to date, which was about 20,000 participants, indicated that the lifetime rate for attempted suicide in individuals with no history of mental illness, depression, was 1%. For individuals with major depression, it was 18%. And for individuals with manic depressive illness, it was 24%. So it definitely is, and that's a point I guess I want to make and could emphasize more and more, is that suicide is something that definitely is associated with depression. I think people come up with a lot of ideas for why people, to try to understand why people attempt and commit suicide, and depression is always something that should be considered first. Certainly not fun statistics, but it has a great impact on individuals and families and the community, because we lose in many ways from not having those individuals contributing. I mentioned that depression has many faces, and that's why it's something that we can all relate to, and that's where students have an advantage. I tell them you can start to develop some empathy because we've all experienced some of the symptoms of depression. Certainly things like burnout, being sad. Frequently these days I experience sadness, existential sadness. I'm sad because of the things that are happening in the world. I feel some of the same feelings people do with depression. Grief and loss. Definitely you can understand depression, those who have grieved and lost, and that would include, I think, probably all of us in the room. In fact, not to experience feelings of depression is probably pretty abnormal. So it's a very normal human experience. Clinical depression, though, major, severe, clinical, whatever term, is something that is different. And that's what I'd like to emphasize. Any questions at this point? I really don't want to just talk. So please interrupt. Depression and our awareness of it certainly goes back, way, way back. And there are always historians, hello, in the group, so I like to throw in a little bit of that for some historical perspective. I see them up here. Probably the best way, I think, if you don't work with individuals who experience major depression, the best way to understand what it's really like is to use the literature. And we certainly have gotten a good sense of depression through the ages, through accounts in the literature, really some interesting material. Hippocrates start way back, again, physicians in the group. Hippocrates related depression to humidity in the brain. I always think it's interesting how our theories kind of evolve. But he, interesting person, I mean, he really talked about the humors and the and different fluids in the brain that cause certain mental disorders. And it's interesting that we have gotten back to that point today, not maybe humidity in the brain, but substances in the brain, the alterations of which may cause major illnesses like depression. So he, in some ways, was kind of ahead of his time. Depression to him was really a surplus of black bile. That was the term. The Greek philosophers, back in about 300 BC, viewed fate as being unchangeable. Hope was an illusion. There was certainly a depressed quality to that. Socrates discussed artistic madness. And I have a book here that I have a reference list for anybody who's interested that is fascinating, Touched with Fire. Some of you may have read this, that really goes through and looks at the numbers of individuals who are artistic, writers, poets, philosophers, who have been touched with fire, primarily with manic depressive illness. It's incredible. I hadn't realized the scope of that until I read that book. At any rate, Socrates talked about the artistic madness, possession by the muses. And quoting him, he said, "If a man comes to the door of poetry untouched by the madness of the muses, believing that technique alone will make him a good poet, He and his sane compositions never reach perfection, but are utterly eclipsed by the performances of the inspired madman. He was talking about the relationship between creativity and illness, mental illness, back then, and that certainly is a topic that has resurfaced. It's getting quite a bit of attention. During the Elizabethan period, moving on, historically, people prided themselves in being melancholic. That was a kind of a positive quality in that particular era. So it was viewed as being a superior malady. And again, I think we're seeing some of that today when we look at the studies on the relationship between artists and, quote, madness. And then in the 1800s, Dostoevsky, Poe, Hawthorne, there was a lot of anguish, depression, grief that was expressed through their writing. And then Byron. And Byron comes through in here as probably the prototypical creative genius who was touched with fire, with mental illness. He said, "We of the craft are all crazy. Some are affected by gaiety, others by melancholy, but all are more or less touched." And then there was Winston Churchill in the 1900s, who was a very familiar figure in terms of his depression, Black Dog of Depression. So there's a lot in the real early history and literature that deals with, that helps us understand how this was viewed. And there's certainly much now, and that's, those of you who, I don't know if I have enough copies, but there are some references that I have up here that I think help us understand from the inside out more what it's like to be depressed. Treatment historically for depression came, of course, quite a bit later, at least treatment that we recognize as being somewhat effective. Somewhere in the 30s with ECT, and the 1950s with medication. So it's been relatively recent. Right now we're in what's called the decade of the brain, which you've probably heard of in terms of psychiatry. And that, this definitely influences how we view things like depression. So when I call depression a brain disease, that reflects a somewhat medical model, which is where we are, that we're looking at illnesses like depression, manic depression, schizophrenia, as brain disorders. That's very different than when I, for example, went to graduate school in psychiatric nursing. My orientation was that these illnesses, or these disorders, were caused by faulty mothering, problems with interpersonal relationships. Those theories are still around, but just so that you understand that where we are at this point is that we're looking at it as a brain disease. And that has very different implications, of course, for treatment, and also for how we view the individual who is depressed. So again, thinking that somebody who's depressed, unmotivated, passive, hard to be around, frustrating, isn't pulling their weight, is not, they can do something about that. They could get busy and pull themselves out of it, isn't real helpful with somebody who's got a brain disease. Just as one wouldn't expect somebody with cancer or heart disease or emphysema to be able to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. So that's the orientation. I just want to be clear that's for my orientation. It is a brain disease. I am not a brain expert in terms of the physiology of the brain. So that's basically my, I know it's a little more than that, but that's kind of where I am with how the brain works. So any questions that are related to exactly what causes depression, how it works, and actually I'm being facetious, but I don't think anybody really knows exactly what causes depression or any other mental illness at this point. There's still theories. Some are just emerging a little stronger than others. And again, the prevailing theory, and I'm sure there are those of you in this room who are very familiar with Freudian theory, that was kind of, you know, popular earlier in the century in describing people who developed mental illness. That there was something wrong with parenting, particularly the mother, that cause things like depression and schizophrenia and everything else you can imagine. At this point, we're looking much more at heredity, genetic factors. And again, nothing has been proven, but there certainly are some indications that genetics plays a major role in the transmission of disease, particularly manic depressive disease. There's pretty strong evidence that there's some kind of genetic link, but what it is, we don't know. So we can't win, moms. It doesn't matter that the Freudian theory is kind of passé. We're still passing things on.
Diagnostic implications. I mean, you keep talking about depression as something that's similar to what we all experience. Does it matter how you think it's caused to be able to identify when someone is depressed? I can understand that there would be treatment implications.
The symptoms for major depression and for other kind of intensities of depression don't vary in kind. Some do, but intensity. So that diagnosis is made, and I certainly don't diagnose, but physicians would, and there may be some in this room who might want to speak to that. But the diagnosis is made on a relatively subjective basis, on less and less so. Thankfully, there's something called the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual that's used to diagnose mental illness. And there are some very clearly laid out kinds of symptoms. And certainly in the case of depression, the mood would be the predominant symptom, that there's a persistent low or dysphoric mood that occurs over a period of time. So that somebody who, for several weeks or whatever, is feeling very depressed, can't get out of bed, whatever, but it isn't a persistent kind of thing, wouldn't be diagnosed with major depression. So things like the persistent dysphoric mood, certainly people who have symptoms of hopelessness, feelings of hopelessness, suicidal ideas, lack of motivation. Now again, these are kinds of things we've all experienced, right? Feeling very passive, can't make decisions, feeling worthless, self-esteem kinds of issues. Those are all, they don't all have to be present to be diagnosed with depression. But if you've got the persistent dysphoric mood along with a number of those symptoms, that diagnosis is made. And again, it's not, there aren't many laboratory tests that can clearly point out depression as there are with other diseases.
Yes, it's really a behavioral problem. I mean, it's an abnormality or it's a type of behavior that is dysfunctional. I mean, the things you point out, you know, these people have no energy, they don't want to get out of bed in the morning, they do it, they're tired, they feel crummy. Oftentimes there's a fair number of vague complaints, headaches, backaches, stomach aches, don't feel good, poor appetite. Some people sleep more than they should, or than they would normally, let's put it that way. Some people can't sleep at all. Some people get to sleep at 11 o'clock and wake up at 2 and can't get back to sleep. All these kinds of things sort of fit into this pattern. You kind of give them a score, I guess, not precisely, you know, so many points and all that, but you get an impression. One thing that depressed people do is they often make you angry.
And that can be used diagnostically.
Yeah, you bet.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And that's something that really is important, not just for diagnosis, but in terms of families and other people, being around people who are depressed. You do get angry. And you get angry working with them as patients, family members. Depression is something that's very, very difficult, certainly not only for the person to live with, but for everybody around the person to live with. And it's very easy to get angry. Yeah, that's an important point. So it is a cluster. Yeah.
If you want to ask any questions of me about being clinically depressed, here I am.
Okay. Good. I mean, that's great, because what I'd like to get into is more the subjective experience of it, because it is the understanding that's important. I mean, I certainly can. Does anyone have? So you've experienced major depression?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's very much in my family. Grandparents on both sides, my mother. It also seems to be related to migraine headaches that I also, grandparents, mother, have. And I guess the biggest problem for me is a profound sadness for no reason when everything is just going great. You know, Jesus is close to me. I have a beautiful home, a lovely wife, wonderful children, great job. Everything's great, and I am so sad that I want to cry.
That's very helpful, and that's very hard to understand. And that's precisely the point that we want to make, is that it's very, very difficult for those of us who haven't experienced profound depression to understand that. We look at people who are seemingly have everything, and we probably all know people like this. I certainly do. Things are going well outside, and yet you don't have that response to that that you would normally experience. So that's the kind of thing that's very difficult. You know, there may not be a particular situation, something going on in the environment that one would have to feel sad about. It does come from what's going on within the individual.
Okay. When my doctor asked me all of the questions to be asked, the only one I said no to is I'm not suicidal. But basically everything else on the list was there. And it doesn't go away. It's not like it's a week or 2 weeks. It just goes on and on. And for me, it gets worse and worse and worse as time goes on.
Which is not unusual. I mean, that does tend to happen with individuals.
Do you have some feeling of hope because of the difference in the treatment, for example, of your grandparents, or the understanding that was there about the situation?
Oh, they had a terrible time.
Yeah, but it seems like we should, through the years, than a generation before, had less understanding of what they were experiencing than for you now.
And I guess what that I
give some
see
hope.
Through my parents and what they talked about, these people made them miserable.
Okay.
When you say these people?
My grandparents.
Made your parents feeling miserable?
Oh, yeah. I mean, my grandfather on my mother's side was obviously extremely depressed. And he made everybody miserable.
It's a very difficult disease to live with.
But probably because no one understood him.
Oh, no, they had no idea.
And you have the, you know, more
he
hope.
Lived on a farm in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And,
that's normal behavior for a lot of those folks.
Yeah. It is something that's hard to distinguish.
But if you have reasons.
Part of the problem, I think, is that we talk about depression as if it's like diabetes. Well, not diabetes is a good example. Strep throat, let's say. It is probably not a single disease. He's inherited something.
That's right.
There are people that have cyclic depression that varies with the season. Called bipolar affective disorder. You know, in the middle of the winter, these people just as soon crawl in a hole and stay there until the sun comes out in the spring. They could never survive in this place in the wintertime. They'd go nuts. They really would.
We're in North Norway.
One of the things my doctor asked me, and usually my best time of year is the fall and winter.
Yeah.
So I'm really totally I start to get my worst depression in the springtime.
You can take the happiest person, you know. Let's say they lose their job, their spouse dies, their kid gets arrested for drugs, they're foreclosing their mortgage on their house. If that guy doesn't act depressed,
yeah,
something's wrong with
him. So are you saying that clinical depression is not usually connected with an event, an external event?
It may look like it, but I've certainly worked with numbers of patients where the depression will come on and they're not able to pinpoint any reason. And again, individuals are very different, and this is an excellent point that, you know, we're not talking about one thing. I mean, it's a very broad range. But people with severe depression, no, not necessarily. If a traumatic event happens to me, I'll respond with depression, with a whole lot of kinds of emotions. People who have chronic recurrent depression, and a number of people do, they will become depressed throughout their lifetime a number of times, and it will come on with no clearly identifiable stressor.
Mm-hmm. It's difficult.
Is the substance abuse a cause or effect?
That's what they don't know.
My understanding is that primarily in the people that I've seen, that substances are abused, it doesn't necessarily cause depression, although it can bring on
that's
illness.
What I wonder, when you talk about 18 years old as an onset age for bipolar, you know, that's the age for my saying you got triggered by something.
Yeah, substance abuse very often, I think, comes along as a result of the illness, or as a, you know, not doesn't cause the illness. You know, if somebody else has a different understanding of that. But it's something, sometimes people use alcohol or drugs to deal with the symptoms they're experiencing, untreated individuals. Sometimes individuals who have manic depression will use substances, for example, like cocaine, to actually continue the highs because they feel good in those highs. So in many cases, what I've seen is that individuals, the substance abuse comes as a result of having the illness and dealing with, trying to deal with the symptoms that are so difficult to maintain. There was a...
I'm curious about that, how things like alcohol and so on affect depression or encourage it. And I'm also curious about how some of the pharmaceuticals that are usually prescribed for depression fight against it.
Fight against depression?
Yeah. The things that the therapist would prescribe.
Okay. Again, I should pull up the transparency of the brain and how the brain works. Because I'm not a physician. Now, you obviously are. Made that appraisal. So somebody else may be able to answer that more clearly, but the new, you're asking about like the new medications that are being used to treat depression, which are, at least in my experience, fairly successful. That's the good news. And they're coming out all the time. However, they do affect levels of neurotransmitters in the brain that are altered, however that happens, because of depression, that are causing the depression. So there's a change in the neurotransmitters in the brain that are affected by the medication.
A lot of everything's going great for you, everything's going good. You got something in the back of your mind that says, this is going to go bad pretty soon. Are you depressed?
Just in a tone.
You're Norwegian. There are many of us, and I am one of them, who's Norwegian, and I really think that that's programmed into me, some of that. I mean, I can do all I want to do my cognitive restructuring. I mean, that's something we use with patients, because people who are depressed, you know, I don't make light of it, do that. I mean, that's one of the characteristics of their thinking when they're depressed, is that they anticipate the worst, the pessimism, I can't do anything right, everything's terrible, that comes along with the disease. But I think a lot of us do that And it's kind
that's
of
healthy then?
Our nature. Well, I'm not saying that. I wish I did, but I know exactly what you're talking about. That's the wonderful difference in all of us. And then there are other people, my husband would be one of them, who is just the opposite. Whoa, things are going well, they're going to get better. We're all different.
What is it about a person who is depressed that causes their people in their environment to be angry? Wouldn't you think they have more compassion?
I can answer that, Margaret. It's because I was clinical. Depressed too, and went to the Prozac bit. And Karen had no idea what she could do to help me. There was nothing that she could do. So this idea of pulling yourself up by bootstraps, you know, it ain't gonna work when you're depressed.
Because you look okay?
You look perfectly normal. I have a good job. I have money for the department. I mean, it didn't make any difference that, you know, just someone, for someone to look at me, they wouldn't know that I was depressed. Karen did. And the people in the church, I mean, people in the movie too, but...
Well, is it a sense of futility of your of the people around you that makes them angry?
The deepest sadness, you can't imagine how sad it is. It's the deepest sadness that there is. And there's nothing you can do about it. Absolutely nothing.
I certainly think that plays a part. I mean, I don't like to be faced with a situation where I know that there's something very wrong, and I can't do anything to change it, or very little, besides being there. I think that sense of futility creates, that makes me angry, and I think that makes a lot of people angry. I also think that some of the behaviors that are associated, that's so characteristic of depression, are frustrating to deal with. I mean, do you like to be around people who don't want to do anything, they're always discouraged, they're always sad, there's nothing that's going right, you feel like you're being just kind of sucked dry? That makes people angry. Even if you have an understanding, and I know that my experience in working with people with major depression, I've worked with a number of individuals, I work with veterans, who have chronic recurring depression, and I should know, and I do know up here, what it is I'm seeing and what they're going through, and yet I have to work really hard sometimes with individuals to maintain my sensitivity, because I'll find myself getting frustrated. So it's excellent.
But aren't depressed people also angry? I mean, isn't that part of depression?
I certainly think it goes along with it. I think angry at a lot of things. It's not the old theory that, you know, Freud had a theory that depression was anger turned inward. You couldn't turn it out, so you turned it in. Not that kind of thing, but certainly there is that for many people.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the difference between grief and loss and depression. For instance, my aunt lost her husband over a year ago, and she is what you would say maybe normally depressed because of this huge loss in her life. And I know that there is a big difference between clinical depression and your loss and grief. And I'm wondering if you can talk about differences.
Again, it's very individual. So I'm real reluctant to say if somebody does this, it's serious, and if they do this, it isn't. Used to think in terms of time frame, and you talk about a year and she's still experiencing fairly intense grief, that used to be kind of the cutoff. You know, if you didn't get over after a year, there was something pathological and you're probably depressed. My understanding is that that's not very helpful and it's not very accurate. Again, people are very individual, and their situations, their losses are very individual. We all respond differently. So that the period of time that people may appear to be in, you know, pretty heavy grief can stretch out for a fairly long period of time. And they will experience the crying frequently. Certainly anniversary dates of all kinds of things will bring it up. If it continues, and certainly there is a period after which, large number of years, when a person does not give up the attachment with that lost person. In other words, they don't move on, they don't reattach. The hole is always there. It never You know, that's not going to change. But people do start moving on eventually. Certainly if they're suicidal, and again, people will express suicidal thinking in intense grieving, and I certainly wouldn't label that severe depression. But if that continues over time, that certainly would be a factor.
I think some of the hardest things with that is that people handle grief and loss so differently, right. And people that feel it very, very deeply and then express it, the people around them think there's something really wrong with you because you should have been over this,
right.
Kind of thing.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, and you've probably all experienced that. I certainly have. That I express grief very differently than a family member who lost my mother-in-law, who lost her only child, who grieved. She grieved differently than those of us around her, and it was very, very difficult for her to understand that we were grieving also because we didn't express it in the same kind of way, and we had difficulty understanding her grief. And yet on the other side of it now, after many, many years, she did go through the grieving process, and she did very well with it, but it seemed very intense at the time, and we had to really look at that very individually. Yeah.
On the grieving, I lived with my parents the last 8 years of their life. We shared a home. So they were part of my everyday life. And in a four-month period, I had a hysterectomy, and both my parents went into their final illnesses. And a year after they died, I still was thinking about them so much of my time that I was concerned about whether it was abnormal. I felt like at the end of the year, I should be better adjusted and it should find its niche. And not that I didn't think I'd always miss them, but you know, I'm talking relative. So where I worked, they were having a religious retreat, and I was invited to attend. And these people were talking about really severe problems they had. And well into it, when I mentioned my feelings, a member who's a doctor looked at me and said, well, why do you think it has to end, this grieving has to end at a year? And I tried to explain the grief, and they just sort of belittled it like it was all right and it would take its time, it would go, and I was a little hurt. But they were right, it gradually did decrease, it just took longer than that magic year. And it settled down and it was all normal.
Right.
But I would like to throw in another question or aspect. He mentioned the seasonal depression. Mm-hmm. And those of us living in the Northwest on the coast side live with a lot of dark, dismal weather, a lot of rain. And I really do feel depressed and down in the winter. And I know what it is. And my friends now talk about it. We're more open than we used to be about it. And we all feel it to various degrees, but some quite a bit. Have you any suggestions on how to cope with this?
Well,
besides money.
besides moving to Arizona.
Right.
That's what we did.
Well, there's a good example of somebody who.
My wife was seriously ill with SAD, and it was a real thing. The first time I heard about it, I thought it was some new flashy thing that some psychiatrist had invented or something, but it's very real. And we were fortunate enough to work out sabbaticals and different things, and we've moved through it and we're discussed it. It's made the difference.
That certainly is an option, but it isn't for some people. The lights, and I'm no expert on SAD, although I live in Minnesota, so I should be. There are a lot of people in Minnesota who are being treated for SAD with the lights, which now apparently are quite inexpensive and very accessible. And
I am familiar with it. Actually gotten into it.
It might be worth a try because it certainly it's nothing that's invasive. You don't have to take a medication, and it works very, very well for many people.
Where do you get them?
Well, you need a prescription, so you'd need to go through a physician to get them. They're not difficult to do.
I don't think so.
Can you take an internal?
I don't think you need a prescription.
Not anymore.
I mean, if you want it paid for by an insurance company, perhaps.
Right, right.
But it's not regulated like any drug. For a while, they were talking about special wavelengths of light coming in these fluorescents for $11 a piece, and needed four dozen numbers of them.
Lots.
Pretty expensive. But I think that's changed.
Yeah, it's gotten much more reasonable. So it's, you know, what I guess I would do is just check it out. It might make a big difference. A couple things, because I really do want to, one thing I want to do is to, because the bookstore told me I should do this, but I do want to focus a little bit more before we finish on kind of the subjective nature of depression. I'll also be talking about depression and suicide tomorrow, so some of this may resurface. But I have shared some really important points about the depression. I guess I feel it's the most important way to understand, to be a little more sensitive. That's probably the best way people can help dealing with somebody who's depressed, is to gain a good understanding of what that must feel like. Styron, this is a book that the bookstore has that I recommended. William Styron's book, Darkness Visible. You know, if you're familiar with this, it's a very quick read, which is nice. This is a book that actually was printed in Vanity Fair, which I thought was interesting. So it's had some wide reading. This is a book that, because I like William Styron, and not everybody does, he uses words in quite interesting manner. But three people very recently who have suffered from severe depression, I recommended this book to a couple of them. One is a colleague of mine at St. Olaf who has struggled with major depression. He has never acknowledged to anyone other than his wife that he is being treated for depression. I asked him if he'd read this book, and he hadn't. He brought it back the next morning and said, you know, this is really helpful. People just don't understand what it's like, and I don't feel like I can tell them because I'm afraid to tell people that I'm being treated for depression. The stigma is still there, certainly less so with depression than some other illnesses, but it's still there. And this is a good example of someone in, I think, a fairly enlightened place, and I would hope he could trust people more, but he doesn't. If people know that I'm depressed, they're going to react to me differently. I'm going to be a very different person around them. He thought that this described the subjective feelings of depression as well as anything. Another student I had at Gustavus has a husband who has chronic recurrent depression, very severe. And for her, this was real helpful. And then I had a student just this past year who graduated, one of our just really bright leader, she was a leader student who began to be depressed during her junior year in nursing and covered it really nicely. And people can cover it for a while, which is interesting. You don't think they could. She covered it quite well. Nobody really picked up on it. She ended up being hospitalized, suicidal. This is a very, very involved in her church. She said, you know, I could not believe that I was having thoughts of suicide. It goes against everything I have ever believed my entire life. She said, but that's part of depression. It's not who I am. It's not me. It's part of that illness. And again, for her, she said, recommended this to the classmates to gain an understanding. Has anybody read this? Who's read? Oh, Heidi.
That's right. That's excellent.
Yeah, it's, you know, I was trying to think of a book that it was real accessible and real quick to read. So I would really recommend this. If anybody wants to borrow my copy, if you're going to be here for a few days, it'll take you, you know, an afternoon. But I just want to read a couple of things that Styron brings out that really, I think, describe what it might be like. One of the things he does is he says right off the bat that the word depression is really a bad one, because it doesn't describe to any extent what this is like. It's much too benign. He calls it a wimp word. That it would help people to understand if you could use a word like brainstorm, but that's already been taken for a good idea. Because he said it's really much more of a terrible storm within your brain than depression. He talks about the word and he says, for over 75 years, the word has slithered innocuously through the language like a slug, leaving little trace of its intrinsic malevolence and preventing, by its very insipidity, a general awareness of the horrible intensity of the disease when out of control. And I hadn't really thought about that. I glibly used the terms depression to describe it. And then I thought, you know, it really doesn't describe what people are feeling at all. He also talks about the pain that goes along with depression, and we can, most of us can identify pain that's pretty awful from having a physical disease. People with depression will describe pain that is every bit, if not worse, than the worst kind of physical pain, and that's hard to understand when taken out of physical terms. Styron talks about his, and he became very suicidal in his depression. He says the pain is unrelenting, and what makes the condition intolerable is the foreknowledge that no remedy will come, not in a day, an hour, a month, or a minute. It's one of the things about when you're in depression, if you agree with this, that there just is no way out. I mean, I could say to you, this will lift, or this will change, and it will, because depressions do, hopefully with treatment, remit. Would you believe me?
Not if, once you go through the treatment, because I had a little bit, but in my own kind of, but you know, you learn tricks that when you hear a trigger, it kind of, at least for me anyway, you talk yourself out of these little episodes. But I only had one major one.
Okay.
So that, but I was really lucky.
Yeah, right.
But you're right, at the beginning of that,
yeah,
you couldn't say anything to me.
No, it's awful. It's never going to change. I'm always going to feel this way. It's that despair. It's the, somebody, I don't know who it was, I can't remember, who said a person who has a why to live for, what is that, can endure any what. It's something that relates to hopefulness. One of the key kinds of things one looks for with people who are suicidal is the degree of hope that they have. Hopelessness is a real scary kind of thing, and somebody who has lost all hope is somebody who may very well be seriously suicidal. So he talks about this, that you just know that nothing's going to change. And if nothing is going to change and get you out of feeling this pain, then it isn't real surprising that so many depressed people will attempt or commit suicide. It becomes very understandable. If there is mild relief, one knows that it's only temporary. More pain will follow. It's hopelessness even more than pain that crushes the soul. So the decision-making of daily life involves, not as in normal affairs, shifting from one annoying situation to another less annoying, or from discomfort to relative comfort, or from boredom to activity, but moving from pain to pain. One does not abandon even briefly one's bed of nails, but is attached to it wherever one goes. And I think that's a real good description of this kind of unremitting pain that people experience. And he did get to the point where he was suicidal, and it's William Styron, and he's very successful, and he's very well known, and he had a lot of things in his life, and he became suicidal. It was interesting, in his case, he talked about what was helpful, and for him it was time. It was a matter of time, and he was in the hospital, and he needed that kind of seclusion. But it was music. If you read this, it's really interesting. It was hearing a particular piece when he was feeling suicidal that kind of got him, mobilized him enough to get the help that he needed at that point. It's different for everyone. A couple other things that he talked about. As the depression gradually took over, he said, and I quote, "I began to conceive that my mind itself was like one of those outmoded small-town telephone exchanges," kind of like the brain here, being gradually inundated by floodwaters. One by one, the normal circuits began to drown, causing some of the functions of the body and nearly all those of instinct and intellect to slowly disconnect. This is a book that I guess I would highly would read first.
What was the name of it again?
It's called Darkness Visible.
How do you spell the author's name?
S-T-Y-R-O-N, William Styron. And, you know, I can leave this up here. It is in the bookstore, so they really do like to sell these. The other one that, we just have 5 minutes left here, so I can't get into this a whole lot, but the other one that may appeal to people deals much more with manic depressive illness, and this is written by a woman who is herself manic depressive. She's a psychologist, and practiced for a while before acknowledging her manic depression. She's written another book called An Unquiet Mind, and that's on the reference list. That's excellent, absolutely excellent book. It chronicles her history with the illness, how it came out and how she coped with it. Highly successful individual. What she's done here is put together, again, those of you with minds for detail. Erling, I probably would really appreciate this. She's just got all kinds of accounts of creative people who have been touched with fire, who have suffered from depression and manic depression. Fascinating. As I said before, Byron comes out in here a whole lot, as do people like Sylvia Plath and Anne Sexton. Poets particularly seem to be connected with manic depressive illness. So the literature folks in here, I think, would find this interesting.
What's the author's name?
Jameson. And again, it's on the, if you want to grab a reading list, it's on there. Are there questions that you have before?
One more question.
Yeah. No.
I had a sister-in-law one time. She's no longer my sister-in-law. But she was either high or low all the time. What do you call her? Is she a depressive person too?
Well, you know, it would be hard to say without seeing her, but if you describe somebody who's got, you know, very noticeable highs and also very noticeable lows, there's a good probability that it's manic depression, which is relatively common. Highly treatable for many individuals, but it's something that can wreak havoc on families. Any of you who have known individuals, I've worked with lots of people with bipolar. Difficult to work with people who are in the depths of depression, but I'll tell you, it's really difficult to deal with people who are very manic. You know, families just get devastated by that disease. On the other hand, that's the bad news, and people suffer immensely. On the other hand, when you get into reading about people who, highly creative people, you know, there is that correlation. That's kind of the good news. Those of us who are very, you know, placid and Norwegian and predictable and average, you know, I'm certainly not touched with fire. I don't have that highly creative kind of thing. And do we want to program that out of people? I mean, that's one of the questions she asks is, you know, how do we want to think about that? Think about the numbers of people that have contributed so greatly and how many of them, and some of you might be interested in looking in the back of this book. She lists, there are just all kinds of people, poets, writers, who have had identified depressive illness.
I think the pragmatic point maybe for any of these things, prolonged grief, bipolar, or cyclic people, are they dysfunctional? The creative people on their, you know, their way up could come up with some brilliant ideas. Problem is, they get past that and their ideas become wacky enough that you know, they just, everything falls apart. I mean, they're making decisions that make no sense. They try to do things that can't be done, and things they get themselves into trouble. But the people that grieve for long periods of time. I mean, if they're getting along, you know, paying their bills, they're doing the wash and taking care of all the things that day-to-day activities have to. That may not be illness.
Yeah, that's the bottom line, is that functioning. And she does talk about that with individuals. There has to be a period of time when they're putting these ideas, they're using these ideas. You know, the other thing she talks about is that a lot of individuals, that their therapy is their art, is their writing. I mean, that's how they've managed their illness, is through that. So again, it really does give, it certainly has given me a different insight.
You know, one thing we really haven't addressed is kind of the social side of depression, because I can see all, you know, there can be genetic factors, there can be a physiological factor, but, you know, what about the person who, and maybe that's why women suffer this malady more than men do, is because they internalize the pain in the world and they see their world not just as their body and their household and their immediate family, but they see this broader picture that at times doesn't look very hopeful. I mean, if what is hopeful to you is, you know, praying for the second coming of Christ is a way of getting out of it, well, there's a lot of room between you and that. And I think, I mean, I'm speaking from my own self. I can see in my own self just allowing myself to be really human sometimes and to really feel the pain in the world and the changes that are taking place, that it precipitates things that could be labeled as mental disorder. An example, obviously, I'm a oldie grad, two ROTC, your former Air Force officer that did, that went to Vietnam, and I came back feeling a lot of grief for my involvement, and this last year and a half ago, whenever the bombing was in Oklahoma City, I'm finding myself as a business owner on a construction site feeling like, whoa, you know, I did that to Hamlets in Vietnam. And there was a point in my life when I could have said, you know, slough that off, you know, forget it. And then there's another point later on down in your life when you start to make your world a little bit bigger and see it in different perspectives and from different angles, and you say, I can't slough that off anymore. You know, those guys aren't much different that are being accused of that than I have been. And that's a whole different element of than what you guys are talking about. I mean, it gets beyond, maybe there's some physiology in there, maybe there's some genetics in there, but there's a whole social element.
That's right. Yeah.
Good point.
Absolutely. And there certainly are people who may be predisposed to having depression, but, you know, the social factors, the other stimuli aren't there. You know, that may bring it out. But there's certainly, there are many, it's probably a combination of all kinds of interpersonal, social, genetic, biological factors that come together. Yeah, that's a really good point. You know, there is something, and we're at our end here, that she said, Jameson said, that just relates exactly to what you talked about. What she sees with people with depression is that people don't really shut down in depression, but in fact are extremely perceptive and sensitive. They overanalyze and overrespond to what's going on, and that may be part of it. And you're really taking it in, and it's really having an effect. And she talks about the fact, now this is her, she says that people with depression may actually have a more realistic view of life because they deny less. It's a real interesting thought. I mean, maybe that's a more realistic view.
And without him having had that experience. So sometimes experiences in life can make a difference in your mental health.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing is a little bit different because we're talking about post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah. Which depression does have along with.
Which has a depressive component to it when you have a traumatizing kind of thing happen. You know, that's what happened in Oklahoma City.
But that's, I mean, where I'm coming from, for example, I see the leading cause of mental illness in America today as being people listening to Rush Limbaugh.
Maybe we should schedule in a session for that. appreciate your input. Very, very helpful. Thank you. Please feel free to take just in the references.